She vanished without a trace, then reappeared 22 days later with bruises, chains, and a story that gripped the nation. But behind the headlines was a lie more calculated than anyone imagined. I'm Sherry Papini, and this isn't a confession. It's a lesson in how I manipulated the media, framed a man who loved me, collected government funds, and turned a hoax into a multimillion-dollar memoir machine. This is the story of how society craves victims, and how I became one. On purpose, you're about to enter the shadows of justice, where manipulation isn't just survival, it's strategy. So ask yourself, if the world believed me once, what makes you think you're different? Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The vanishing point. They called it a disappearance. But the truth is, I never left. I staged it. Every scratch, every bruise, every sob calculated, engineered, controlled, because what I really wanted was to disappear from a life that felt like a perfectly painted coffin. It was November 2, 2016, when I walked out of my home in Redding, California. I told my husband Keith I was going for a jog. My kids were safe at daycare. My phone was with me. But by the time the sun set, I had vanished. People would later say I vanished without a trace, but that's not true. I left traces, meticulously, like a trail of digital breadcrumbs that led nowhere, because I had already gone where no one would think to look, to the home of my ex-boyfriend, James Reyes, in Costa Mesa, 500 miles away. He thought I came for healing, but in truth, he was just part of my script. I had memorized every detail of the lie. Two Hispanic women, dark SUV, chains, duct tape, branding. I practiced it in the mirror for weeks. The burn on my shoulder? I did that to myself, using a heated tool and steely resolve. The bruises and broken nose? I begged James to help me stage them. He didn't ask enough questions, because he still loved me. And love, when unreciprocated, is the easiest tool of manipulation. The FBI launched a multi-state investigation. Hundreds of hours of manpower, helicopters, dogs, a reward fund, and my husband, Keith, crying on TV, pleading for my return. That was the part one didn't expect to sting. Because in the middle of this con, this masterpiece, I saw what love actually looked like. And I knew I was desecrating it. 22 days later, on Thanksgiving morning, I reappeared. I was found wandering near a freeway in Yolo County, still in restraints, still bearing the marks I gave myself. They rushed me to the hospital. They photographed my injuries. They listened, really listened, as I told my story of captivity. And they believed me. America believed me. And why wouldn't they? I was a white woman, a mother, crying on cue. I described my captors in just enough racial detail to bypass critical thought. Was it ethical? No. Was it effective? Completely. The media ran with it. CNN. Fox. People. 2020ths. Dateline. I was the new face of victimhood. They called me brave. Survivor. Resilient. But behind their praise was the truth I buried deeper than the burn on my shoulder. I wasn't trying to escape kidnappers. I was trying to escape myself. Back home, things were different. Keith tried to be patient, but he asked too many questions. The FBI was still running forensics. The DNA they found on my underwear, that wasn't my captors. It was James. And the story started to crack. But I doubled down. I cried louder. I offered flashbacks. I described details that never happened. I even wrote victim statements to deepen the illusion. Until the day they brought me in for questioning again, this time with receipts, phone records, money I'd withdrawn, James's confession, my own texts. I denied it. At first, my mind racing, trying to weave new lies fast enough to hold up. But it wasn't enough. In March 2022, the lie shattered. The FBI charged me with making false statements to federal agents and mail fraud, because I had even collected money from California's Victim Compensation Fund. I stood in court in April 2022 and pleaded guilty. I admitted it, all of it. And in September 2022, I was sentenced to 18 months in federal prison. I had to repay over $300,000 to the government, law enforcement, and those who tried to help me. That prison wasn't made of chains. It was made of shame, of interviews I'd never be able to undo, of the image I created, and then destroyed. But the part no one talks about is how many other women reached out to me. Some angry, some scared, Some inspired, because I didn't just fake a kidnapping. I exposed the shadows of justice, the market dynamics of media victimhood, and how dark psychology thrives when human emotions run unchecked. I became a case study in behavioral psychology, cognitive techniques, and social dynamics. Now I spend my time studying persuasion methods, audio manipulation, and psychology tips, because knowing how I fooled the world is the only power I have left. Some call me a monster. Some call me mentally ill. But me? I call myself skilled. The safe house and the scapegoat. It wasn't a basement or a dungeon. It was a spare bedroom, in a two-story apartment, decorated with laundry piles, incense sticks, and dreams that never left the pages of a notebook. That's where I hid. James Reyes. My old flame. My safety net. My scapegoat. He had no idea I was going to frame him. Not at first. He thought I needed space. Healing. A reset. But what I needed was a body to hide behind. He picked me up in a rental car. I left my phone behind, removed my SIM card. I had memorized every stoplight and toll booth between Redding and Costa Mesa. The moment we pulled into his complex, I knew. This was my server room, my offline bunker, where the world would stop looking, and I could begin shaping the story of my life. James was living small, coasting on handyman gigs and nostalgia, still nursing the wound I left behind years ago when I chose Keith. Still hoping, in that lonely way only men like him hope. I let him believe this was love rekindled, that I needed him, that we were meant to vanish together. I told him about the dark forces I imagined chasing me, how I'd been followed, watched. I whispered shadowed secrets into his ears at night, fabrications that made him feel like a hero. The more unhinged the stories, the more he clung to me. That was my manipulation, my psychology tip for pulling strings, make them feel needed. And while he ran errands, buying gauze food supplies, I spent hours designing my wounds. In front of the mirror. No emotion. No panic. Just practice. I studied cognitive psychology and body intelligence like I was prepping for an acting role. The bruises had to be believable. The cut on my shoulder had to scream branding without saying self-inflicted. I even starved myself to lose weight so the captivity would look real. Every time James questioned something, I kissed him. Touched his cheek. Switched topics. Mitigation techniques. Silence through seduction. By the end of the second week, James had become a ghost. Just a caretaker in his own home, barely speaking. He told me once he felt like he was playing a role in someone else's life. I almost laughed, because that's exactly what he was. One night, I snuck into his bathroom and searched for anything that could brand skin. Curling irons, tools, lighters. I found a wood-burning pen in a toolbox under his sink. It was a blur of heat and nerve endings. And in the morning, when James saw the burn, I told him it happened in my sleep. Flashed a PTSD gaze I'd practiced a dozen times. He cried. And that's when I knew. He'd never out me. I used his laptop while he was gone, cleared cookies, wiped location data. I looked up offshore accounts and ethical marketing tactics. Not because I needed them now, but because when this was over, I was going to monetize everything. True crime sells. I had no intention of being poor when the curtain dropped. On November 24, 2016, I told James the first had to leave. That I'd had a dream I was being rescued. He didn't fight me. Just nodded and kissed my forehead. I walked out into the early morning fog and called it in. 22 days after vanishing, I reappeared on the I-5 in Woodland. Bruised. Bound. Disoriented. That's what the cameras saw. What they didn't see. What no one saw. Was how I had manipulated not only a man's heart, but the entire media ecosystem. How I used group behavior, market emotions, and behavioral psychology like paint on a canvas. I was my own artist. And James? He was just the brush. But nothing stays hidden forever. The problem with using people? They remember. And when the FBI knocked on James's door months later, he spilled it all. The apartment. The branding pen. The rides. The Google searches. The chilling calm in my voice. He gave them the truth I never thought he'd tell. They found his DNA on my clothes, text messages between us, and phone records I had forgotten about. I had underestimated him. And now, I was a hero unraveling. A con artist losing grip. But it wasn't over yet. I still had one card left. The American public. America's perfect victim. America didn't just believe me. They needed to believe me. And I gave them exactly what they craved. A photogenic mother, traumatized and trembling, returned from the jaws of hell just in time for Thanksgiving dinner. A made-for-TV miracle, raw, tragic, headline perfect. I was no longer just Sherry. I was a national narrative. And that kind of attention, that kind of spotlight, it can melt steel or make a god. By the time I reappeared, I had been missing for 22 days. The headlines wrote themselves. Supermom abducted while jogging. Sherry Papini's harrowing survival. Branding, starvation, and escape. They focused on the what, not the how. The bruises. The broken nose. The duct tape still tangled in my hair. What they didn't know, what they didn't want to know, was that it was all my design. My masterpiece. And for the next several months, I played the role flawlessly. Every media outlet lined up. People Magazine, ABC News, 2020ths. I gave carefully curated interviews, guided by ethical marketing instincts I'd sharpened on parenting blogs and mompreneur forums. I had learned early that market dynamics weren't about truth. They were about emotion. And I knew exactly which strings to pull. When the California Victim Compensation Board approved my request, I pocketed over $30,000, covering therapy, blinds for my windows, even a gym membership. No one blinked, because the tears were real enough. The pain was scripted, but the performance was Oscar level. Keith, my husband, stood beside me, publicly supportive, privately shattered. He never saw it coming. He had no mitigation techniques for betrayal. I studied him every night, measuring how much longer the illusion could hold. He'd ask things like, "Why did they let you go?" Or, "What made them stop hurting you?" And I'd pause, just long enough to imply trauma, before answering with some shadowed truth about mercy or motherhood or prayer. It worked. Until it didn't. Because facts are stubborn things. And the FBI? They aren't America. They don't need to believe you. They need to prove you wrong. They started digging. They analyzed cell tower data. They matched DNA found on my clothing to an unknown male, later confirmed as James Reyes, my ex. They reviewed old text messages I thought I had deleted. They pulled surveillance footage from Costa Mesa, placing me blocks from his apartment. And when they confronted me, my mind raced like it did on that first night, the panic of exposure, the urge to spin, pivot, twist. But the walls were closing in, so I made a choice. I did what all skilled con artists eventually do when cornered. I doubled down. I told them James had kidnapped me, that he had manipulated me, that I was afraid for my life. I even suggested, quietly, indirectly, that he might have been working with traffickers. It was absurd, but it bought me time. And time, when you're unraveling, is everything. In private, I began prepping my next move. I started learning about NLP techniques, body language control, and cognitive skills that might help me survive what was coming. Because this wasn't about jail. This was about legacy. I needed to turn the eventual confession into a redemption arc. A memoir. A docuseries. A true crime podcast. Because in America, the fall from grace is just another product to sell. But Keith, he couldn't take it anymore. He found a message on an old burner phone I had hidden in the garage. One message. One name. James. And suddenly, the man who once cried on live television for my return was filing for divorce, taking full custody, turning his back on the woman he once loved so fiercely he couldn't imagine her gone. He stood in the kitchen that night and said, "You destroyed something sacred," and I wanted to scream. "No, I manipulated it. There's a difference." But I just nodded. Let him feel like the victim. Let them all feel like the victims. Because that's the final act of control. That's mastering leadership in its darkest form. Turning everyone's deep emotions into a mirror that reflects you as innocent. But the mirror was cracking. And the reflection was about to shatter. Cracks in the story. They say lies have short legs. But mine? They wore designer running shoes and sprinted for nearly 6 years. I had almost made it. Until the cracks started forming. Hairline fractures in the mirror I'd held up to the world. Little truths leaking out like whispers beneath a locked door. First, it was the DNA. A single strand pulled from the clothing I escaped in. Not Keith's. Not mine. Not imaginary masked women. But James Reyes. It was like the universe was unraveling my web, thread by forensic thread. When the FBI asked me about the DNA, I clutched at another lie. Said maybe I had been assaulted while unconscious. That I was confused. That trauma had blurred my memory. But they weren't buying it. Their tone changed. Their questions sharpened. They asked me about PS1 video games, James's collection. They asked me about a prepaid cell phone they'd tracked to his apartment. They asked why the wood-burning pen found in his garage had a burn pattern that matched mine. The mind racing began again. Panic used to fuel my stories. But this time, it drained me. They had me. The agent leaned in and said, "We know you weren't kidnapped, Sherry. Tell us the truth." But what was truth at this point? That I staged it because I was drowning in domestic emptiness? That I missed the feeling of being chased, of being seen? That my soul had grown claustrophobic inside the role of perfect wife, perfect mother? That wasn't truth. That was confession. And confession is weakness. Instead, I gave them fragments. Maybe I ran away. Maybe James misunderstood. Maybe it was both. The word mitigation came up. It echoed through that cold interview room like the first hint of plea bargaining. They didn't arrest me, not yet. But I could feel the weight pressing down. At home, Keith was a ghost. His silence louder than any argument. The kids, my babies, looked at me like I was glass they were scared to break. And in my journal, I wrote one word over and over. Control. But control was slipping. Then came March 3, 2022. The FBI came with handcuffs and an indictment. Charges. Making false statements to federal agents. Mail fraud. Collecting over $30,000 in victim compensation while knowingly lying about the crime. The mugshot went viral. I wasn't America's perfect victim anymore. I was a con artist. A headline. A fall from grace. I watched the story flip in real time, from Sherry survives to Sherry lied. Social manipulation only works when people want to believe you. But once they don't, you become the cautionary tale. In April 2022, I stood in federal court. The plea deal laid out in front of me like a coffin lined with silk. 18 months in prison. Full restitution, $309,902.23 to be exact. I was to pay back local law enforcement, federal agencies, and the state victim fund. I said the words, "I'm guilty," but they felt like someone else's voice. Because I hadn't lost, I had just changed tactics. See, by pleading guilty, I bought myself a different kind of power. Now I was the woman who admitted the lie. The woman who owned her darkness. The woman who could tell her side finally in her own words. I told my lawyer to start reaching out to documentary producers, podcasters, publishers. I had spent my time in jail studying dark psychology, art techniques for trauma healing, cognitive behavior, and even ski techniques. Yes, because skiing, like lying, is about controlling the descent. I mapped out a true leadership strategy for life after bars. I'd speak on forgiveness, on society's hunger for redemption. I'd write a book on audio manipulation and the illusion of truth. They thought prison would break me. But for women like me, it's just a rebrand. I served about 10 months. And in August 2023, I walked out of that facility with more clarity than I'd ever had. The shadowed secrets had become strategy. The shame had become a storyboard. And James, he faded back into the nothing I had plucked him from. No charges. No fame. No legacy. But me? I was just getting started. Because the world doesn't remember liars. They remember those who turn lies into legacy. From inmate to influencer. I was inmate hashtag 67398-509. Federal Correctional Institution, Victorville. A medium security prison with beige walls, buzzed gates, and bored guards. But to me, it was the most liberating place I'd ever been. Because for the first time in years, no one expected me to be perfect. Not a mother. Not a wife. Not a miracle survivor. Just a felon. And felons, ironically, get to be human again. I spent 10 months behind those walls. Not sulking. Not repenting. But studying. Every day, I woke up at dawn and journaled. Read transcripts of courtroom manipulation. Watch lectures on cognitive psychology and NLP techniques through a reentry program. Even participated in trauma recovery sessions. Not because I needed healing, but because I needed data. I was building a brand, a curriculum, a new persona for the new world waiting on the other side of the barbed wire. I knew the hashtags they'd use. Hashtag manipulative monster. Hashtag Sherry the liar. Hashtag kidnap hoaxer. So I prepared my counter-narrative. Hashtag redemption arc. Hashtag body intelligence. Hashtag surviving myself. Inside that prison, I found my own kind. Women who'd turned pain into power, guilt into skill. I connected with an ex-finance exec busted for offshore accounts and tax fraud. She taught me market psychology better than any professor. Another woman? A former cult recruiter. She schooled me in group behavior and social engineering stories. Together, we called it the Mastermind Club. Prison wasn't punishment. It was a PhD in psychological warfare. By the time my release date approached, I had 5 chapters of my memoir drafted. A podcast pitch. A virtual TED Talk titled, "How I Manipulated the Nation, and What It Taught Me About You." They thought they buried me. but I was planting roots. On August 22, 2023, I stepped out. New hair, new tone, same mission. I was assigned supervised release until 2026. No passport, no unsupervised contact with media. But that didn't mean I couldn't write, or that I couldn't influence. I moved to a small rental house in Northern California, quiet, wooded, healing, according to my parole officer. But inside that house, I built a home podcast studio, soft lighting, glass mic, crisp audio filters. I rehearsed lines about redemption, shame, and society's thirst for narratives, about how women are punished harder for lying than men are for assault. It didn't matter if it was true. What mattered was the emotion it triggered. That's ethical leadership in this new world, stirring emotion until people forget what stirred them. I created a private Patreon channel. 3 tiers. Exclusive access to my raw truth. Zoom Q&As. Signed copies of my upcoming book, The Perfect Victim: How Lies Become Truth in America. I even started dabbling in art exploration and trauma-related creative writing techniques, teaching followers how to reclaim their story. They didn't care that I invented mine. They cared that I sounded like I meant it. That's audio manipulation at its peak. I met someone new, too. A man who didn't flinch when I told him the truth. A former counselor with a past of his own. He listens, never judges, believes in second chances the way some believe in celestial insights. We take long walks. We talk about market emotions and the public's love for watching women crash and crawl back. He says I should stay away from the spotlight. I tell him the spotlight follows me. Because no matter how deep the shadows, some names never die. But Keith, he doesn't return calls. He has full custody of the kids now. I get supervised visits on Saturdays, an hour, two at most. They don't know the whole story. And maybe they never will. Maybe all they'll remember is the name. The myth. The woman who faked a kidnapping and got caught. The woman who manipulated a nation and walked away with a book deal. But I'll remember the silence of prison nights. The pages I filled. The women I met. The tools I sharpened. Because I may have lost the sympathy, but I gained clarity. And that, the memoir machine. They say when you hit rock bottom, you either die or publish. I chose the latter. Not because I needed money. Not because I wanted redemption. But because I wanted the final word. The world had spoken for me long enough. Lawyers, reporters, comment sections, even Keith. But this time, it would be my voice, my cadence, my truth fabricated, fractured, filtered, but mine. I called it the memoir machine, this calculated content engine I built from the bones of my shame. Part confessional, part strategy, all performance. It started with a blog, anonymously posted, then podcast snippets, then leaked chapters from a book in progress. The headlines practically wrote themselves. Sherry speaks, what really happened that November. Papini's prison diaries reveal shocking secrets. Victim or villain, Sherry Papini breaks her silence. It worked. By early 2024, publishers began circling. One even flew out a ghostwriter. We met at a coffee shop in San Rafael. He asked, do you want the world to like you or to never forget you? I sipped my oat milk latte and said, both. We spent weeks crafting the structure. 7 chapters, each tied to a core manipulation method, each laced with enough dark psychology to keep the reader unsure if I was confessing or still conning. I name-drop techniques like anchoring bias, mirroring, groupthink, emotional priming, and trauma bonding. I cite cognitive psychology journals. I compare myself to war generals and stage directors. And somewhere in all of it, I slip in real pain. That's the trick. Make them feel you bled, so they'll forget you cut yourself. My favorite chapter is called The Perfect Crime is Emotional. It opens with a quote I wrote in prison. To control a story, you don't have to own the facts. You only have to control the feelings attached to them. By mid-2024, the book was sold. A 5-figure advance. Podcast spin-off rights included. Streaming interest was brewing. An 8-part limited series, pitched by a production company that called my story morally provocative. They said I reminded them of Anna Sorokin and Elizabeth Holmes. But I'm not them. They chased empires. I chased attention. There's a difference. I hired a media strategist who used to work for influencers post-scandal. She cleaned up my online profiles, helped me schedule content with psychological pacing, and taught me marketing tools and tactics to rebuild my brand as a reformed manipulator. She made me rehearse cry points during podcast interviews. We mapped color-coded timelines of shame and triumph. We designed merch, hoodies that said truth is complicated, postcards quoting prison entries. Some cages are invisible. It worked. People began to shift. Not all at once. Not publicly. But in DMs. In comments. In late night listens. They started asking, do you regret it? Do you still talk to Keith? Was any of it real? And I told them what they wanted to hear. I cried every night. I miss my kids. I made mistakes. I've changed. But here's the real truth between us. I'm still the same woman who engineered a fake abduction and framed a man who loved her. The same woman who saw market dynamics in motherhood and media psychology and trauma. I'm not sorry. I'm strategic. Because that's the final frontier of ethical manipulation. When you convince the audience that you've reformed. So they hand you the mic again. And I didn't stop there. I began speaking at women's conferences, virtually at first, then in person. Topics ranged from overcoming personal narratives to the psychology of public perception. They ate it up. I used slides with buzzwords like body intelligence, positive influence, human dynamics in media, true leadership after failure. The audience clapped, cried, lined up for autographs. Some wore their own trauma like armor. Some saw me as proof they could rise. Some just wanted a selfie with someone who beat the system. But none of them asked the question that mattered most. Was I still lying? The answer? I don't even know anymore. Because somewhere between the act and the aftermath, the con became the character. And now the character? She's the brand. And brands don't feel guilt. They feel momentum. Legacy in the lie. There's a strange peace in being infamous. Like a storm that never passes, but starts to feel like home. I used to fear it, this legacy of lies. But now I understand something most people never will. Truth doesn't survive the noise. But a story outlives everything. Even you. Since the memoir's release, the world has been louder than ever. Some hate me. Some idolize me. Some don't know what to believe. And that's exactly how I designed it. This wasn't just a kidnapping hoax. This was a social experiment in real time. A lesson in market emotions, psychological priming, and how ethical standards bend when painted in pain. I took the world's blind spots, race, motherhood, trauma, and used them as chess pieces. I manipulated news cycles, exploited group behavior, and activated cognitive techniques that most people only read about in textbooks. I took the language of survivors and turned it into a mirror. You didn't see me. You saw what you wanted to see. And now, I teach others to do the same. No, not how to lie, but how to engineer stories. How to make an audience feel before they think. How to use body language, voice modulation, and behavioral psychology to become unforgettable. It's not criminal. It's commerce. You call it deception. I call it strategy. But something changed recently. Something I didn't plan for. My daughter, she's older now. Old enough to Google. Old enough to ask. She looked at me the other day, her eyes full of questions she didn't yet know how to form. And for the first time in years, my voice caught. Because no amount of persuasion methods, no audio manipulation, no ethically branded redemption arc can prepare you for that. For being unmasked not by a journalist, but by someone who shares your blood. She asked if I was still lying. And I smiled. Said, sometimes people lie because they're scared. She nodded. Didn't press. But I saw it. The seed of doubt. The beginning of the end. Not of my brand, but of my human connection. That's the part one didn't write into the script. The part where the game exploration becomes real life. Where the lie lives on, even after you've stopped telling it. I've been offered a reality show. A consulting gig for a film studio writing true crime screenplays. Even a partnership with a startup creating AI behavioral coaching tools. The irony is poetic. The woman who faked her trauma now trains others to spot manipulation. But the truth? Even I can't always spot it anymore. It's in the subtext of interviews. In the way people flinch or lean in when I talk. It's in the silence before a question. The breath before applause. Sometimes I wonder if the real punishment wasn't the 18 months they gave me, but the lifetime of being doubted, of knowing I built my fame on a false foundation, and watching it hold. My children may grow up ashamed, or curious, or strong enough to reject me, and I have to live with that. That's my real sentence. Not a sell, but a legacy, etched in interviews. In podcast episodes, in social commentary threads, a legacy built on shadowed truths, but carried by human emotions. And that's what no one tells you about manipulation. It isn't always loud. It doesn't always look like evil. Sometimes, it wears a mother's face, and whispers just enough sorrow to be believable. So when you ask me, do you regret it? I'll tell you this. I regret losing what was real. But I will never regret mastering the tools and tactics to take control of what wasn't. Because control, that's the only truth that's ever mattered to me. And now it's the only thing I have left.